From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Maglev is a technology that could whisk passengers from Baltimore to Washington in 15 minutes. But at what cost? We get a reality check from the CEO of the Northeast Maglev, Wayne Rogers, and Brian O'Malley of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. Then Amy Scott, who covers education for Marketplace from her perch here at WYPR, talks to Tom Hall about the film she's just produced. Oiler tells how a community school in Cincinnati transformed itself and the lives of many of its poor students. Plus, after a career in advertising, Ronald Smith has turned to writing the kinds of stories for young people he'd like to read. He tells us about his scary debut novel, Hoodoo, and the environment in focus with Tom Pelton. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're observing Yom Kippur today, have an easy fast. And if you'll be celebrating Eid al-Adha tomorrow, Eid Mubarak. Now we're going to discuss superconducting magnetic levitation, commonly called maglev. This is the technology that might move you from downtown Baltimore to BWI in 5 minutes and on to downtown Washington in another 10 minutes on trains that move faster than 300 miles an hour, not with wheels rolling on steel tracks, but cars that would float or levitate inside concrete pathways. If it sounds like science fiction, maybe that's part of its appeal. When the Northeast Maglev Project threw itself a party this week to celebrate opening its Baltimore office, city and state leaders seemed almost starry-eyed in their support. Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank, who's on the project's advisory board, said, "I love big. I love blowing people's minds. Let's build this thing." But as futuristic as it seems, Maglev has been trying to get started in Maryland for more than a couple decades. A previous proposal hit legislative snags a dozen years ago, and there's always been a big price tag. Now it's estimated building the first leg of a Northeast system, that line from Baltimore to D.C., would cost $12 billion. We want to get a better idea of what momentum the project has this time around and what questions Marylanders should be asking. So we've asked Wayne Rogers, CEO of the Northeast Maglev Project, to join us. He's on the line from Annapolis. Good morning.
Morning, Sheila.
And with me in the studio is Brian O'Malley, president of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
So, Wayne Rogers, why are you convinced this very expensive project is the right investment for people in this region?
You look at the Baltimore area, and we're really drowning in congestion. I mean, all the way through the Northeast Corridor, things are getting worse and worse. In the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen traffic go up by 40 or 50%. Our infrastructure is lagging, and the airports are overcrowded. 70% of all air traffic delays in the United States come out of the Northeast Corridor. Six of the 10 worst airports in terms of congestion are in our corridor. The rail system is overcrowded. We need a new solution, and it's not what we've done in the past. We have to look forward and look elsewhere to see what other people have done.
Brian O'Malley, it sounds great. There's a lot of buzz around it. Why are you skeptical?
Well, let me be clear that the Transportation Alliance is not opposed to or in favor of maglev. We're technology neutral. Maglev is a technology, and it could be the solution depending on what our goals are. But what we need to have is a plan, and there's a huge projected increase in demand for travel on the Northeast Corridor, everything from commuters using commuter trains and other ways to get to and from jobs to families and people traveling for personal reasons to business travelers. And we need to make sure that we're meeting all of that demand. And I should add freight as well. So maglev could be part of the solution, but we need to make sure we're asking the right questions and that whatever technology we choose is the most effective way to achieve our goals.
Well, when you talk that way about looking at lots of technologies, then Wayne Rogers, that pulls me back into thinking about the the expense of this approach? I understand about half the money to build the Baltimore-Washington route is expected to come from Japan's government, which is interested in spreading the maglev technology that it has developed. Where would the other $5 or $6 billion come from, just for this first leg of the project?
The other $5 or $6 billion is going to come from federal government and private investment. And really, we have to look back to what Brian just said and said, we have all of these users in the Northeast Corridor, and that's really part of the problem. We have a single rail line that is not straight, so it isn't something that you could put a high-speed passenger rail line on. We're using roughly 9 passenger railroads and 4 freight railroads, all using the same tracks that are woefully outdated. And so the only way we're going to move lots of passengers is to build a new railway line. And if we look at that, and we looked at it, we're building a computer or buying a computer or a new phone, no one's going out today and say, I would like an iPhone 1. You know, I would like an iPhone 6. And so if you look at it now, why don't we have a cell of trains every 10 minutes? If we look back at the reason is because there's no room on the rails. So I could have a Ferrari on the Beltway, but it doesn't help me in the morning.
Right.
If I look back and see what's happening in Japan, Japan Central Railroad moves 150 million people on high-speed trains that they've had for 50 years. And they have a train every 4 minutes, trains going over 200 miles an hour. Average delay in a year is 30 seconds for 150 million people. And at the same time, have never had a fatality. I mean, that's the kind of transportation we need in America, not delays, overcrowded, and ancient infrastructure.
Brian O'Malley?
I think that the Federal Railroad Administration is also studying a second track for a high-speed rail technology that would be different from maglev. They're also studying improvements to take out some of the bottlenecks on the existing track. And we should be weighing the costs and benefits of those options, including maglev, and getting behind the one or the combination that will best meet our needs. It's terrific that there's an opportunity to leverage investment from Japan or other private sector investment or federal dollars here, and that should be factored in. But I'd like to see them competing on the same playing field to make sure we're getting the best deal for Marylanders.
That's Brian O'Malley of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance here on Maryland Morning, WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, talking to Wayne Rogers, CEO of the Northeast Maglev, or TNM. And we're talking about prospects for maglev between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. So, Wayne Rogers, what kind of fares would need to be solved? Fares would need to be charged to pay off this kind of investment?
We think it'll depend on the final alignments of the railroad, but we think it's going to be equal to, I mean, if we have a D.C. to New York service, that would be equal to what you'd be paying, you know, in the time frame for an airline ticket, or equal to what we'd be paying on a high-end Amtrak fare. And we have to really keep this in perspective, too, because when we talk about the Northeast Corridor, you know, we have over a $2 trillion economy, 40 million people or so would be living in the corridor, an economy equal to the United Kingdom. So if I had an old car and said, I need a new car, yes, you could look at putting a new engine in it, but it's never gonna provide you what you need. If we make these incremental improvements on the existing rail, we'll never get the rail system above 150 miles an hour. And at the same time, we still have freight rail that's using the same system. So our proposal is to put a new line that's going to be passenger only, and you'll be able to travel at 300 miles an hour. We'd be able to move people every 4 or 5 minutes. You'd be able to land in BWI Airport and be in D.C. in 8 minutes. I mean, what does that mean to the economy? For a Baltimore business, Baltimore City businesses would have access to 800,000 more workers around Baltimore. And if we was a Baltimore City resident and said, I'll do a 60-minute commute, you'd have access to 4.2 million more jobs within an hour.
But let me put two things you just said together. If you talk about fares at the level of high-end Amtrak fares, or you even mentioned competitive with airplane fares, you're not talking about
fares for commuters to jobs. Most people, unless they're going to a very high-paying job, can't afford that.
Well, it all depends on how it's addressed. I mean, right now, if you compare it with the MARC train, the MARC train recovers about less than a third of its cost. So when
50%.
We say, I beg your pardon?
The MARC train fare box recovery is about 50%.
Okay, that wasn't my understanding, but it's subject to check. But even if we say 50%, and I think it's less, it's not really fair to say, okay, we're going to take a subsidized service by the state and compare that with an unsubsidized service.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to raise something that I think may be on some listeners' minds. As I understand it, Wayne Rogers, much of the distance between Baltimore and Washington for this would be underground. That's part of how you solve problems with community resistance to the high speed, et cetera. We just saw the state kill the Red Line light rail project, largely on the grounds that the tunnel it would have required would have been, the governor said, unfeasibly expensive. Explain to me then why it would make sense to do this kind of miles of long tunneling for this project.
Well, the Baltimore BWI Washington leg is really the first leg of a train that's going to connect the Northeast Quarter. So when we look at the Red Line and look at the maglev train, they're really not comparable. It's a local transit system with something that's really going to allow us to bring the entire metropolis from New York to Washington closer together. So we'd be able to live wherever we want, work wherever we want, and travel at very high speeds.
We have just a minute left, Brian. You want to make a last point?
Yeah. The Transportation Alliance thinks maglev could be part of the solution, but our focus is getting people to jobs. And so having a commuter rail system like MARC that works is a key part of that. Having a bus system that works is a key part of that. And I have to say that I've been hearing from a lot of people who are angry about the discussion of maglev, not because they're opposed to maglev per se, but because they don't feel like we're addressing the other needs. And seeing the Red Line cut, seeing funding for the bus system reduced is part of that frustration with people. So we need a plan that really identifies what are the goals, what are the needs, and getting people to jobs is a key part of that. It could be transformative for economic development to have this business travel option, but I don't think it replaces or substitutes for the job of the transportation system to get people to work.
We are flat out of time, and obviously there's a lot more to talk about. I am grateful to both of you for walking us through at least this much of it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wayne Rogers is CEO of the Northeast Maglev. Brian O'Malley is president of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Ahead, transformative schools. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. And echoing Sheila's greetings, for those of you observing Yom Kippur today, Gemar Hatima Tova. And if you're observing Eid al-Adha tonight and tomorrow, Eid Saeed. Amy Scott is my guest this morning. Her voice is familiar to anybody who's a regular NPR listener because she's the education correspondent for Marketplace. Amy is based here in Baltimore. Matter of fact, her office is right downstairs from mine here at WYPR. And during the 2012-13 school year, Amy did a series of stories for Marketplace called One Year, One School, in which she reported on a community school in Cincinnati, Ohio, called Euler. And in the process of doing that reporting, she directed and produced a documentary film about the school. And tomorrow night at MICA, she will screen that film at the Maryland Institute. It's called Euler. And Amy Scott joins me in Studio A. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning. Great to see you, too.
And congratulations on your first motion picture.
Thank you.
It's a very interesting thing. Tell us a little bit about the area of Cincinnati. It's a neighborhood called Lower Price Hill. Tell us about that neighborhood where Euler is located.
Yeah, this is a really unusual neighborhood, at least to me. I grew up in Colorado and had never heard of urban Appalachian culture. I didn't know what that meant. Lower Price Hill.
Yeah, that's interesting. Urban Appalachian. Yeah. You don't think of those two terms together, do you?
Right. So after World War II, a lot of coal mining jobs evaporated in the Appalachian region, West Virginia and Kentucky and eastern Ohio, because of new technology. So a lot of people moved to urban centers like Cincinnati looking for factory work. And a lot of them ended up settling in this neighborhood that's now known as Lower Price Hill, right near the Ohio River. A lot of factory jobs. Those, of course, went away. And this neighborhood had gradually become, as the principal that I follow in the film put it, an economic desert. A lot of poverty. Traditionally a largely white neighborhood, but it's become more diverse over the years. And kids in this neighborhood were not finishing high school. There wasn't a high school in the neighborhood itself. When they went to bigger high schools in Cincinnati, they didn't feel that they belonged, and most of them dropped out. So until about 10 years ago, there were very, very few kids graduating from high school, let alone going to college from this neighborhood.
So when you encountered this principal, who's an amazing character, and we're going to hear from him in just a second, a clip from the movie, this is the 2012-13 school year. What did you find? What kind of physical plant did they have there at that point?
Well, I actually did my first story about Euler for Marketplace in the spring of 2012, and they had moved up the hill to a temporary location while their original school building, which dated from 1930, was being renovated. And they were in this kind of squat, very stereotypical, frankly, kind of ugly school building, low slung, you know, cinder block walls. And I did the story and wasn't that impressed. It was an interesting story about a school with lots of services for its kids, but the building itself was not that interesting to me. But someone recommended I drive down to the old neighborhood before I left. And I went down and checked it out. And there's this beautiful brick and terracotta, very stately school building that was being reconstructed and surrounded by dilapidated row houses, boarded up buildings, empty lots, weeds, you know, the size of trees growing through the sidewalk. And the school really seemed like a symbol of hope in the neighborhood. So I was very taken with that. The school would be reopening that fall with a new preschool, a vision center, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I got an idea that there was more to this than one radio story, and that if I could be there when the school reopened, it could make for a very interesting, not only radio series for Marketplace, but a film.
And one of the more interesting dimensions of this film is a guy that you follow around, the principal of the school. His name is Craig Hockenberry. He's an amazing guy, and this is an amazing story. Here's a little bit of Principal Hockenberry sort of telling, giving us a little glimpse into what a typical day for him is like.
A little girl coming in, third grader, covered in dirt with one flip-flop yesterday. The other one busted on the way in. This was January. I could call her mom and say, you know, where's her shoes? Be mad and call 241 kids and say this is neglect. Or I could just find a way to get this girl a shoe. I want to do something that's, you know, much, much different than probably a lot of principals. I want, you know, the boards to come down off the houses. I want less crime and people from outside our community coming in and selling drugs. I want to start working on the neighborhood, the streets.
Craig Hockenberry, he's the principal of Euler, the topic of Amy Scott's new documentary film on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Amy Scott joins me in the studio. So this whole notion of not just offering classes, but offering this sort of holistic range of services is really at the core of what folks have come to call the community school movement. Tell us about that movement and all the things that are involved.
Well, it's really been around for decades, the idea that a school is the hub of its community. But in the last 10 or 20 years, there's been sort of a resurgence of this idea that schools should be more than a place to teach children academics, and more than a place to warehouse children during the day while their parents go off to work. And there are all kinds of services that are cropping up. Euler, I think, is pretty unique. I mean, you walk in this building and go down the hall, and it looks like a lens crafters inside the school. I mean, rows of glasses, you know, shiny cases and big pictures on the walls of smiling kids. This is pretty unusual. But a lot of schools, in fact, here in Baltimore, there are about 50 community schools now, increasingly are trying to provide services, sort of, they're known as wraparound supports. So after school programming, nutrition.
You mentioned that they're serving 3 meals a day in these schools.
Right, yes. Kids increasingly now can get breakfast and lunch in public school, but Euler is serving a dinner meal and sending food home with kids on the weekend, because many of these kids won't have enough food to get through the weekend. So they bring a backpack home with shelf-stable food that will last them a while.
And I guess the alternative, or as in education circles, as people, you know, look at these problems, before the community school movement, the alternative was to bus the kids or to ship the kids from their neighborhood to some other school somewhere, rather than have the school in their neighborhood, in their community. And you alluded to this at the beginning of our conversation this morning. I guess when that was happening to some of these kids from Lower Price Hill, they didn't fit in. They found it very difficult to go to a school that wasn't literally right in the neighborhood they lived.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting idea, because for the school choice movement has really taken off. And I was just in Chicago where kids spend, sometimes a couple hours a day commuting by bus to another school. And there are lots of good reasons to do that. Their families want a better education for them. But I think this community schools idea is investing in the school as a place where the kids know their neighbors, they see their neighbors day in and day out, and especially in high poverty neighborhoods can get the kinds of services that they're not getting at home.
We are introduced in your movie to a fascinating young woman named Raven Gribbins. Here she is telling us a little bit about her.
I lived in Lower Price Hill my whole life. It'd been rough, but it'd been okay, too. Everybody used to tell me, you're not going to make it through high school. You're going to have a baby by 16. So I'm glad to prove all them wrong.
And one of the points you make in this movie, we are introduced to Raven's father, who is illiterate. So here's his daughter getting through high school, and we follow her progress, and we see what happens to her. And the Principal Hockenberry and the staff at the school, incredibly dedicated, doing their best to get her enrolled in a college. And you see how the father reacts to that. And there's two sides to that, right? There's a bifurcated kind of emotional response to that, isn't there?
Yes. It's, I think, one of the most poignant moments in the film is seeing his kind of bittersweet reaction to her success, because I think he sees what he could have done had he stuck it out. He was one of those students who went to a big city high school, didn't feel that he fit in, and dropped out. And he never, as you learn, he never really learned to read and write. So clearly his struggles began much earlier than high school. And one of the things that a teacher says in the movie is that kids in Lower Price Hill are not being told that they are college material at home. In fact, they may be told the opposite. He says, you know, they hear, you're not going to go to school. You're no better than me. Why would you get to go to college? No one in our family has ever gone to college.
And yeah, Raven growing up, people saying, oh, you'll just have a baby when you're 15 or 16 and that'll be the end of it. Yeah.
So the school is really trying to overcome that message. And I think Raven's father is very supportive. But you can see that if she leaves, in some ways she leaves the family behind. And that's scary for families, I think.
How practical is it
for a school to provide so many of the services and so much of the emotional support for these kids, excuse me, that parents traditionally have supplied. I mean, we're talking, there's a daycare in this school. There's an eye clinic. There's a health clinic. There's meals served. There's tutoring. And there's attention paid to these children that, you know, long ago and far away, used to all be done at home by mom and dad.
Clearly, it's not practical for every school in every city. In Cincinnati, I think it works because the deal is the schools don't pay anything extra for these services. They're provided by nonprofits and city agencies that would be providing those services anyway. They do it rent-free in the school building, but they have to use their own budgets. So, for example, the Vision Center and the health clinic bill Medicaid. And that's how it's worked. That's not going to work everywhere. But a lot of people argue it should be part of school budgets. The impetus for this film came from an op-ed I read suggesting that prenatal care should be part of the education budget. Because teachers argue by the time they get these students who've had so little in those crucial 0 to 5 years, there's a lot that they can't make up for just with good teaching. So if we want to have an educated workforce and help people escape poverty, the argument is we have to address poverty itself.
And is the school the best place for this kind of thing? In other words, is the school the optimum place as the central hub of the neighborhood, you know, as opposed to, I don't know, maybe the library or a church or a synagogue or something?
Well, it makes sense for families because that's where kids are going every day. That's where they spend the bulk of their time. The parents are going to be dropping them off. It makes sense when they pick them up to maybe go in and have a parent education class. I don't think it works in every neighborhood, particularly where a lot of students are leaving the neighborhood to go to school. But in a place like Lower Price Hill, that is the hub.
And of course, none of this model would work without the kind of principal that Principal Hockenberry is. Here he is addressing the basketball team before a big game.
You're his brother. Don't let him do that stuff. Tackle him. Drag him in here. Tie him to something. This is our only chance that we have to be winners. You guys fought every game last year. You were an embarrassment. And now nobody can beat us because everybody's playing together. But one problem throws everything off. When a fight breaks out, people lose their lives. One wrong move in this neighborhood, and you're not going to college.
Yeah, you're not going to college. That's the theme constantly. We got to get you to college. You're going to college. You're going to, and he's saying that 50 times a day. How many kids have they been graduating in the last few years?
Every year, about 40 to 50 kids.
Which is a huge spike for what they were.
Compared to zero.
Yeah.
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 Their graduation rate is still under 60%, according to the state metrics, and that's too low. So they're really working on addressing it. But compared to what they were doing, it's significant improvement.
So you shot this movie while you were reporting on it for Marketplace? You sort of doing a little double
yes,
duty?
Yes,
each
I did. I foolishly thought that this was something I could fit in my spare time. Marketplace was really supportive. I actually hired a local Cincinnati crew to shoot when I couldn't be there, and there was they did great work throughout the school year, and I tried to be there as often as I could.
You're a very experienced radio reporter. What was it like making the switch to documentary filmmaking?
Well, I had actually started out in documentary film long ago. I went to the graduate school at Berkeley, the journalism school at UC Berkeley for documentary film, and had made a thesis film about a high school marching band. I got into radio and really had never looked back until that moment when I drove into that neighborhood and saw this very visual story. So it's been great to do it. I think radio is a lot easier. This film took me almost 3 years to make. It was very expensive. But, you know, yeah.
Well,
worth it.
Yeah, hit a home run your first time out, kiddo. So congratulations. I look forward to the panel tomorrow night.
Thank you so much.
Amy Scott, she's the education correspondent for Marketplace and the producer and director of Euler, documentary film produced in association with Marketplace. I hope you can join us tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, at the Maryland Institute College of Art for a screening of Euler. It'll be followed by a panel discussion that includes Craig Hockenberry, who's the principal of the school, and Raven Gribbins, one of the students who is featured in the film, along with some folks who are involved
involved in the community schools movement here in Baltimore. I'll be the moderator. We'll be at the Falvey Hall at the Brown Center at MICA, 7 o'clock. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stick around.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Ronald Smith, who lives in Baltimore, had a career of a couple of decades writing TV spots and commercials. His book writing, his fiction, was put to the side until he found himself rediscovering books he'd loved as a child. He's just published his debut novel called Hoodoo, and Ronald Smith is with me in the studio to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
In this book, hoodoo does not mean just what most of us might think of the word folk magic or conjuring African-American spirituality. Hoodoo is the name of the young man at the center of the book, your narrator. Tell us about Hoodoo.
That name just kind of came to me. Hatcher is a family name.
His name is Hoodoo Hatcher.
Hoodoo Hatcher, yes. And I just thought it had this kind of really neat alliteration to it. I don't know if an actual folk magic practitioner would call himself or herself Hoodoo, but I thought it had a great ring to it, and that's why I wanted to use the name.
So how old is he? Where are we meeting him?
Hoodoo's 12 years old. He's in a small town in Alabama in the early 1930s. And like many people during that time and era, it's the Deep South. It's the 1930s. It's a segregated South, although the story itself is a story of magic and fantasy and adventure. And while I wanted to portray the world as real as possible, I didn't want to delve too much into those issues. I really wanted to write a story for kids that was more about the character and kind of bring to light the type of books I like to read as a kid, but have it be a little bit more unique because this is an African-American kid in a time and place that we don't see often.
Well, you told us why you like his name, Hoodoo Hatcher. Why does his family call him Hoodoo?
Well, that's his name. I mean, I think when the first line in the book says, you know, he was born with a birthmark under his eye that's shaped like a heart, and his grandmother says that boy's got hoodoo in him. So she sees it as a symbol or a sign of some latent power that's in him that somehow is going to have to come to light.
And, of course, that's what we learn about. I have no intention of giving away the plot, but I figure something you put in the first chapter is fair game for an interviewer.
Okay.
And this book gets scary right away in the first chapter. A stranger shows up in the country store with a weird request.
The story is pretty dark, I guess you could say. As a matter of fact, one editor wasn't interested in it because she thought it was a little too dark. But, you know, I mean, being scared is kind of fun to read from the safety of your own home if you're a little kid. And I like scary stories. I like scary books and movies. So Hoodoo is going about his day. He's at his cousin Zeke's corner store, I guess you could call it, you know. And some of these things come from childhood. I mean, I remember taking trips down south as a kid, and there's always a store where you can find, you know, candy and kind of penny candy. I think it's pretty much a thing of the past at this point. But anyway, he's at his cousin Zeke's store, and he's daydreaming, as many kids do. I know I did when I was a kid. And something, somebody, something, some spirit comes into the store, and he's asking for something. And Hoodoo is in the back sweeping up, and he actually hears what this man, creature, thing, whatever he is, he's asking for. And it's something very strange. It's a word that Hoodoo's never heard before. And that sets off a kind of chain of events. And he gets wrapped up in it.
And all the way through, it's like the real world that most of us have experienced, like going into a country store and buying some penny candy. And an other world is coexisting in Hoodoo's life. Did you know that that's what the book was going to be like when you started it?
Not really, because, you know, a lot of writers, they like to plan everything out. They've got index cards, they've got scriveners, they've got notepads and charts and post-it notes. I don't do that. I can't do that. I've tried to do that, and I just get confused. So I'm more of an organic writer. I think that the writer George Martin compares it to gardening as opposed to being an architect. So he just kind of organically let things grow. So I don't really know where the story's going when I started, but it kind of takes shape and you begin to see the paths that it can take. And that's what happened with this book.
That's Ronald L. Smith, a Baltimore resident. We're talking about his debut novel, published this month, called Hoodoo. Hoodoo has a style of sharing parts of the story. This struck me as a little cheeky, maybe even a little snotty. He says a lot, if you don't know. Like, Hop and John is black-eyed peas and rice, if you didn't know. Is this pattern supposed to tell us something about Hoodoo and his personality, or is this just a useful device for you as the writer to make sure that kids get a definition of some phrase that they may not be familiar with?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I mean, it's a neat little catchphrase. I mean, the book is historical fiction, so I think a lot of kids who read this book aren't going to be familiar with the time or place or what even some of the things that are in the book, what they really are. So I wanted to, you know, certain types of food, certain types of slang, language, you know, and since the book is a time and place in the Deep South in the 1930s, there are a lot of things that people are unfamiliar with. So to Hoodoo, these are just things a part of his natural life. So he tells us what Hoppin' John is. He tells us what an outhouse is. He tells us what things his grandmother says to him. So I think it's a way for kids to learn of something new, but also not in a way that's, you know, being lectured at or trying to teach a moral lesson.
And Hoodoo obviously is not telling his story to an adult like me. Who do you envision Hoodoo is telling this story to?
I think that he's talking to everybody. I mean, children's literature is a great category because you can have very kind of innocent things geared towards younger readers. You can have things that are very sophisticated. And when I wrote the book, I just wrote the type of book that I would want to read. So I think he's talking to whoever it's reading.
You wrote the book you'd like to read. Why are you writing horror?
It didn't start out that way, Sheila. I mean, the first line came to me and, you know, I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy and Ray Bradbury and The Lord of the Rings and Flights of Fancy, but it turned into a horror book. I mean, it's historical fiction. I guess it's kind of Southern Gothic, which is, you know, is usually dilapidated mansions and willow trees and weeping willow trees and a tragic character. And I thought of it more as a Southern Gothic story, but the more I got into it, I saw the potential for really scary stuff there. And at first I had a hard time describing it. And then I said, well, I guess it is a horror novel of sorts. So yeah, it's Southern Gothic horror. So I think that's pretty unique.
What's your next book?
Well, it's called The Mesmerist, and it's a completely different type of book than Hoodoo. It's also historical fiction, but it takes place in the early 19th century in London. And it's about a young girl who finds herself in the middle of a war and the plague and seances and fortune telling and lots of creepy stuff.
More scary.
More scary stuff, yeah.
There are some people who would probably expect a black author to be sort of more sermonizing or more focused on raising consciousness about black issues.
Well, you know, black people are just as diverse and just as non-monolithic as other people. I mean, we all have different stories to tell. You know, people may expect that from black writers, but I don't. That's really part of the whole idea of We Need Diverse Books, which is a movement in young people's literature that wants to show kids of different races, you know, gay, straight, transgender community, to show that some representation of themselves in books. So I think that whoever you are, there should be a book for you. I don't think that because you're black, you need to write about black issues, or because you're white, you should write about white. You write about what inspires you.
Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Ronald Smith, his debut novel is titled Hoodoo. He'll be speaking about it this weekend at the Baltimore Book Festival, Friday afternoon at 1:30 at the Enoch Pratt Free Library Children's Stage. 2 weeks later, Friday, October 9th, he'll speak at Kid LitCon on the Middle Grade Horror panel at the Hyatt Place. We've got more information at our website about both events, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1868, the Chesapeake Marine Railway and Dry Dock Company was chartered on Kennard's Wharf at the end of Philpott Street. The black-owned company, whose African-American founders included John W. Locks and Isaac Myers, employed both black and white workers and was a center of Baltimore's shipbuilding industry. We'll be back on Friday. Hope you will be, too.